Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. We have two cases this morning. Before we begin, I'd like to make a couple of administrative notes. First, in light of the long-standing vacancy we have had on the court, we have invited Senior Judge Stuckey to participate, and we are very grateful that Judge Stuckey has agreed to do so. Secondly, I'd like to note that we have in the audience today two barristers from the United Kingdom, and we extend to them our special welcome. So, without further ado, our first case is United States versus Pullings. Major Bosner, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Major Spears, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Major David Bosner, and along with co-counsel Major Sean Raleigh, we represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Travis Pullings. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I would like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
This court should answer both granted issues in the affirmative. My client suffered cruel and unusual punishment for 247 days and nights at Lowndes County Jail in Georgia. He was denied the necessities of food, water, medical treatment, sanitation, and even fresh air, all the meanwhile human excrement flowed into his dark, bug-infested jail cell.
Counsel, this is a curiosity question. How did he end up being there for 247 days when he went in, he was supposed to be there for what, 2 weeks? There's an aside in the brief about how he was just sort of sashaying through the Lowndes County Jail on his way to elsewhere. And instead, bang, he's there for 247 days. Did the Air Force forget he existed?
It's certainly possible, Your Honor. The record's silent as to the reasons for his incarceration at Lowndes County lasting over 8 months. My client's declaration before the Air Force Court acknowledged that he was told he'd likely be there for 2 weeks, and then nothing happened.
Otherwise, this was one of those, somebody said something, and then poof.
Yes, Your Honor, and there's nothing I'm aware of in the record otherwise that would indicate why.
Right. Okay, well, don't waste your time on it. Go ahead.
And my client exhausted his remedies both inside the jail and out, and to no avail. And the denial of his necessities were the product of a culpable state of mind, deliberate indifference on behalf of both prison officials at Lowndes County and the military officials who sent him there and kept him there. The Air Force knows of these deplorable conditions, so much so that it has adopted a standing 3-for-1 confinement credit policy for all airmen they sent to that installation, even knowing the likely harm that those airmen are about to endure. And in my client's case, those harms did occur. The wing commander found rights violations in the Article 138 complaint, and still nothing changed.
Can we focus a little bit more on the law here? I'd like to focus on something that you touch upon in your brief in terms of it's the interaction, the interplay between Irby and Pena on one hand and Jesse on the other hand. Now, in essence, Jesse circumscribed the post-trial supplementation of the record. And, of course, with Irby and Pena, we've got the post-trial claims that would require the record to be filled out, supplemented. How do we reconcile? How do you think this process would work in terms of these types of post-trial claims in the world of Jesse?
Understood, Your Honor. So when we look at the clause of and determines based on the entire record should be approved, the end of Article 66D, that on the basis of the entire record clause modifies and should be approved. So in our position, that applies to the sentence appropriateness duty of the CCA. Correctness in fact and law is in the text above that clause. So our position is, and the basis of the entire record the sentence that should be approved is not so qualified by on the basis of the entire record. Now, we look at Article 55, the prohibition against...
But I just want to be clear on that point. You're saying that is not modified by based on the entire record?
I think that's a fair reading of the organization of Article 66D, is that on the basis of the entire record modifies the clause that immediately comes after it, which is, and should be approved. And in cases like Gwynn, this court made very clear to demarcate the different duties of the CCA to determine what is correct in law and what sentence should be approved. So it's a fair reading of Article 66D to say that on the basis of the entire record modifies the sentence appropriateness aspect, and that's consistent with this court's decision in Willman. But it doesn't necessarily modify the preceding clauses for what is correct in fact and law. And we have to look at correctness in law, what this court has called the main charge of the CCA, in the context of the entire statutory scheme, which of course includes the prohibition against the infliction of cruel and unusual punishment. Article 55 has no temporal limitation to it, and there is nothing in Article 66 which states that evidence about cruel and unusual punishment must exist prior to the entry of record. So if we look at the entire statutory scheme, and we can see that subchapter 8 in the Manual for Courts Martial in the UCMJ, which starts off labeling it sentences. So the chapter about sentences. The first article is the prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. Congress did not want cruel and unusual punishment to be imposed as a punishment under the UCMJ, nor inflicted upon a member subject to the code. So that's how the statutory scheme on sentencing starts out, and then immediately transitions into Article 56, which are the appropriate mechanisms for punishment.
But how are you tying this into my Jesse question? Now, in your brief, you state, as long as an appellant mentions any confinement condition, he or she could supplement the record because confinement is part of that. Wouldn't that entirely swallow the reasoning of the majority in Jesse?
It would to some extent, and that was the point I was trying to articulate in the brief. So as laid out in Jesse and further recognized in Willman a year or two later, the general rule is on the basis of the entire record. But we have these two exceptions that case law recognizes. One that allows for record supplementation in perhaps like the IAC context or something of the like. And the second is this cruel and unusual punishment, Irby, Pena, and White. And the reason why the Irby, Pena, and White, this other exception to the entire record exists or became part of the case law is because of this court's recognition of the important place Article 55 sits in the UCMJ. It sits in a position discussing sentences. And it recognizes as Congress's intention for Article 55 to be fully honored in the context of sentencing, neither imposed as punishment, nor should any member subject to the code have cruel and unusual punishment inflicted upon him or her. That's the reason why this court over time recognized that in White and Irby and later Pena, is that the quality of post-trial confinement can surely unlawfully increase the punishment that was adjudged at the court-martial. So when...
The mental gymnastics that this court has to repeatedly go through to deal with these kind of Eighth Amendment claims, these post-trial confinement claims, doesn't that suggest that the system isn't the right place to be hearing these? These struggles we have with supplementing the record, not supplementing the record, was it raised, is it part of the record, doesn't that suggest that Irby and White, which are arguably very inconsistent with Article 66 and 67, is just the wrong way to do this?
I don't think so, Your Honor. If this court has struggled over the decades with reconciling the cases with the statute, or opinion after opinion creates these mental gymnastics that courts and the attorneys representing clients before this court have to go through. That would be for Congress to rewrite Article 66 or 55 in a way to make it more clear. But what we have now is the main charge of the CCA is correctness in fact and law. Also sentence appropriateness as a corollary. But its main focus is correctness in law. And Congress is surely
But what do we do with, right, the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces may act only with respect to the findings and sentence set forth in the entry of judgment. Like, none of this was set forth in the entry of judgment, right?
Well, Your Honor, the sentence is set forth in the entry of judgment.
Right, but certainly, and you say that this requirement would be absurd, but certainly the entry of judgment doesn't say, and pullings shall be denied fresh air and water and subject to sewage in a cell, right? None of that is in there, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, nor would it ever, which is particularly emblematic of why an appellant ought to be able to supplement the record. Because Article 55 places no temporal qualifications, it just says full stop, cruel and unusual punishment shall not be conflicted, and the CCA, in this court, has a corresponding duty to ensure that the sentence as executed is correct in law.
But why does that duty end then on direct review? It's just a happy accident, right, that these allegations happen before it comes up on direct review, before the CCA and before this court. But if it happens next week or a year from now, what would your client's recourse be?
At that point, the client's recourse would be to file suit in state or federal court as appropriate under the circumstances.
I think isn't that the way every other criminal justice system in the United States, state and federal, works?
Yes, Your Honor, but every other criminal justice system doesn't have Article 66 and 67. So the rights that service members enjoy under our unique military justice system and our unique military justice appellate system affords him or her other rights that are not necessarily reflected in other circumstances. Supreme Court.
Now, in terms of your response, though, to Judge Hardy, in your brief, because I noted it because it struck me, page 8 of your reply brief, you said the CCA and this court are required to view how the days, months, and years of appellant's confinement are experienced by appellant. That seems different from how you just responded to Judge Hardy's question.
In the days, please allow me, Your Honor, an opportunity to qualify that statement. How the days, months, and years are experienced by appellant during the course of the appellate review, right? So Article 66
okay.
and 67.
Let me move on then to something else. And it's building upon the question that was posed by Judge Hardy. This seems like such a jury-rigged system that this language that 20 years ago, 2001, was language that had been around for 50 years, and suddenly this court found this right somehow in that language. And since that time, we've come up with this jury-rigged system, whether it's dealing with debate hearings or whatever, why shouldn't we say, look at the statutory language and say, we have to cabin our authority to what the statute says. Congress, if you want us to do something like this, give us the procedural means to do this in the correct way.
Your Honor, a few responses to that. One is that Congress is presumed to know this court's case law when it enacts new legislation. And with the most recent rewrite to Article 66, Congress is presumed to have been well aware of this court's jurisprudence, which allows appellants like my client to bring this claim before the CCA in this court. Congress did not make it explicitly clear with the Military Justice Act of 2016 in Article 66 or 67, that it intended to change the landscape of appellate review. Article 55 wasn't changed at all. Article 66 was only changed with conforming language So that is the clearest indication this court could ever have that Congress desires this court to maintain its jurisprudence.
If that were the test, wouldn't that sort of swallow the whole stare decisis test? If a court interpreted a statute and thinks they got it wrong and Congress they could never go change that decision unless Congress intervened and changed the statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's an indication of what Congress means with this language. This court is always free to utilize the stare decisis principles in reviewing its own decisions. Congress explicitly changing language in the statute or specifically electing not to do so, however, is an indication that Congress agrees or seeks to not alter the trajectory of this court's jurisprudence. And I can't say this more simply than this. Chief Judge Olson, you recognize that all of a sudden 20 years ago, this court recognized this right explicitly in White. But it had always been around. In the case that kind of brought it to the head in United States versus White was Sanchez the year prior. And there was a concurring opinion and a dissenting opinion in Sanchez. The dissenting opinion written by Judge Sullivan very clearly states Article 55 UCMJ makes post-trial punishment a matter of law.
And what was the reasoning that Judge Sullivan gave in his dissent?
The reasoning he gave is if Article 55 is a statute and the CCA and this court have a duty to make sure the sentence isn't correct in law, and the law is being violated, it now is within the purview of whether the sentence is correct in law.
Now, why wouldn't that logic have won the day in Clinton v. Goldsmith?
Your Honor, I see my time
Please continue.
Clinton. Right? I mean, the language in Clinton v. Goldsmith, it was, to be fair, it was a bit of a smackdown, right? And you know, we have already seen that the CAF's independent statutory jurisdiction is narrowly conscribed since the Air Force action to drop respondent from the rolls was an executive action, not a finding or sentence that was or could have been imposed by a court-martial proceeding. The elimination of Goldsmith from the rolls appears straightforwardly to have been beyond CAF's jurisdiction. Why isn't the executive action by the Bureau of Prisons or whoever is responsible for the allegations here, why isn't that merely beyond our jurisdiction?
The answer, Your Honor, is Article 55 is unique. Article 55 has a very specific, targeted charge that it shall not be inflicted upon anyone subject to the code.
Is it an offense?
No, Your Honor, it's not an offense. However, Congress saw fit to make it the first thing in the subchapter on sentences.
But why, if it's a statute, right? It's a federal statute. Why couldn't an Article 3 court hear the exact same claim for a violation of Article 55?
Your Honor, just
what is unique about our jurisdiction, as limited as it is, that makes this court or the CCAs the right place to hear such a claim better than the, you know, federal district court in Kansas?
Well, Your Honor, federal district court presents its own challenges, such as perhaps a military member's lacking an opportunity to receive damages. There are other hurdles, such as qualified immunity or other injunctions that may be hard to enjoin on military officials performing military duties.
Look at the remedies here. You've simply got a reduction in the sentence for the accused, but that doesn't go to changing what happens in that facility for anybody else. And the reduction of the sentence is not necessarily a benefit to society, certainly not to the victim. So why is that a preferable remedy as compared to putting it into U.S. District Court, where you can get injunctive or declaratory?
My first response to that is alternative forums is more of a policy argument, and I see it differently than as whether Congress authorized this. Our primary argument is Congress authorized this court to do so. The Supreme Court said in Schlesinger.
Now, when you say authorized, you're referring back to the same language of 66 and 67.
Correctness in law, factual sufficiency, sense of purpose, these are large, robust charges from the federal legislature to the military appellate courts that don't have an analog. And military appellate courts are up to the task of vindicating the constitutional rights of the accused. Now, there is also...
Was the appellant's sentence lawful the day of the entry of judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it was only later in time, sometime after the entry of judgment.
Your Honor, I want to quickly qualify my quick response to you. At the entry of judgment, the confinement conditions had already started to germinate, and he was subject to them. So to that extent, he was suffering from cruel and unusual punishment when the entry of judgment was signed. I took Your Honor's question to mean when the court-martial announced the sentence to...
But if they were already present, why didn't he raise it at that time with the convening authority?
Your Honor, one of the challenges that appellants face, like my client, in the 2019 construct of the rules for courts martial, is the submission of matters to convening authority happens mere days after the announcement of sentence. Now, 10 days is when the submission of matters had to be into the convening authority. My client's harm that he suffered didn't fully manifest itself except over the course of over 8 months. So the opportunity to complain to the convening authority over those 8 months has now been severely restricted by the rules. So if we look at it from a holistic perspective of you have to complain to the convening authority about everything that's about to happen to you, it's very hard to do. Perhaps if he had said in his submission to the convening authority, my first few days at Lowndes County Jail have been terrible. I reserve my right to come back to you in the courts later and tell you just how bad it's been. That gets to Your Honor's previous question of swallowing the rule from Jesse about record supplementation. My interpretation of Jesse is that would be sufficient for him to supplement it later. But why shouldn't he, when this court has said, file your grievances, file your Article 138 complaint, go to the CCA, then come to this court. My client followed this court's instructions, and it takes time. It takes time. So to have done all this in less than 10 days is impractical, if not impossible.
Major Bosner, going back to the question of whether or not the military system is the best place to adjudicate this kind of an issue, it seems to me, and tell me if you can, generally, in these kinds of cases, the appellant is seeking sentence relief, in other words, sentence credit. Now, I notice in your case, you're asking for a remand back to the CCA for them to reassess the sentence or do a debate hearing or whatever. What ultimately, in your case, would your client be seeking? That's the first question. And then, if it is something like sentencing credit, isn't that a remedy that is not available in the federal district court? I'm not aware that federal district court can order confinement credit for a military prisoner.
Certainly, Your Honor. My client is seeking confinement credit. A federal district court would not be able to do so. What he'd be seeking from federal district court is to have the officials enjoined from putting him in these conditions. But here we are, multiple years after his conviction and the announcement of the sentence. He has, after 247 days, been removed.
So the harm, from your point of view, that your client had suffered is now mooted by the passage of time.
With regard to
injunctive or declaratory relief.
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree with that proposition. Pending any further questions from the court?
I have one more question. One of the things that you've raised before this court is whether or not we should alter or extend, maybe is the right word, our law to extend the deliberate indifference standard to military officials. So, you know, in that case, why wouldn't, but if we decide this issue, then if this issue gets raised again on collateral relief in front of a district court, what standard of review are they going to apply to these, to your client's claims? Will it be full and fair consideration? If we decide your opponent hasn't suffered any Eighth Amendment or Article 55 violations, and he wants to raise them again before a district court, it'll be full and fair consideration.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Wouldn't he be better off starting in front of the district court instead of coming here? If our case law is too narrow and we don't extend the standards as far as an Article 3 court, why wouldn't he be better off in the Article 3 court to start with?
Your Honor, at the time he arrived at Lowndes County Jail in May of 2020, there were still hurdles with him filing in federal district court. An obvious one is the Ferries Doctrine would essentially prevent him from receiving compensatory damages. Injunctions may be hard to realize. Filing.
Do you think if a district court thought there were Eighth Amendment violations occurring that they wouldn't issue an injunction?
That's not what I intended to communicate. If they had thought so, perhaps sure at the time. However, there's still the federal judiciary's announced reluctance to interfere in military affairs, and military confinement could be properly classified as such. So that's another cross-section between the federal criminal justice system and the military justice system, where this system is more appropriate to vindicate a military accused or appellant's constitutional and federal statutory rights than in federal district court.
More questions?
Okay, thank you.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Major Brittany Spears, and together with Major Jay Peer, we represent the United States. The Lovett deliberate indifference prong should not be expanded to include military personnel who send service members to confinement facilities with an alleged history of inhumane conditions. And this court should take this opportunity, which it has invited, to reconsider its prior precedents, which allow it to consider post-trial confinement conditions that are not a part of the entry of judgment. And finally, appellant was not subjected to cruel and unusual punishment while he was at Loudoun County Jail. First, this court should decline to expand the deliberate indifference prong of the Lovett test to include military personnel for two reasons. First, it expands the plain language of this court's authority and CCA's authority outside the plain language of Article 66 and Article 67 even further. And the Supreme Court has long held that when a statute's language is plain, it is the sole function of the court to enforce it according to its terms. While this court has carved out an exception for Article 55 and Eighth Amendment claims, appellant seeks to expand the test that this court uses to analyze those claims even further by including a separate category of individuals, the military personnel.
Major Spears, let me ask you this. How about a hypothetical that is well beyond the facts of this case? And suppose you have a situation where the accused is being held post-trial in a civilian confinement facility, and it is the worst of the worst. It would make the Tower of London look mild. And suppose further that the accused has brought this to the attention of his command, and they do nothing. They take the viewpoint, well, you're in jail, and jail is jail. Yes, it's tough in jail, but you shouldn't have been there in the first place. I'm just supposing. I'm not suggesting that that's this case or it could be some other case. I'm not impugning the honor or integrity of any military official or military officer. All right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. But suppose you have that situation. Now, what should the accused do at that point? In other words, let's say it's a contracted facility. What is he supposed to do? He's gone to his command. He's gone to the officials running the Tower of London. And he has gotten no relief.
Yes, sir. Remedies are never going to be limitless. So looking at your hypo where you actually have conditions that are horrible that a service member is enduring, he has to use the remedies that are available to him. And if he's not getting relief with those, that might be an unfortunate situation in that case.
So the government's position can't be that too bad, so sad.
Of course not, Your Honor. But the remedies that are available to service members that are in these conditions, they can file the prisoner grievance, use that system. They can file an Article 138. They can file a claim with the Inspector General. They can file a congressional. At some point along those lines, if the conditions are really that bad, someone will step in.
Okay, so your position is that you have enough faith in the system, whether it be the military system or be the congressional system or the administrative system, that ultimately the accused could get some relief in the most horrid situation. That's what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. And with the Article 138 complaints, it's not just limited to one individual in command who's going to ignore the complaints. The complaints would go to the person's squadron commander first, then it goes to the wing commander, it goes up to the GCMCA, and then eventually the GCMCA has to respond to the Secretary of the Air Force or the Secretary of that branch to explain the actions that it took. And if the conditions are Tower of London awful conditions, then I have faith in the system that someone along with
I'm not asking you to testify now.
No, Your Honor, but someone along the line would take action if the conditions really are that bad.
Okay.
Well, to follow up on Judge Sparks, leaving aside the fact that the Tower of London, for much of its existence, wasn't that bad.
But, I was wondering if, I know Judge Stuckey's old, but he can't possibly be that.
Oh, I don't know, old Bill the Conqueror. Anyway, what do you do? I'm not talking about where the GCMCA just blows off his responsibilities. I'm assuming he's doing what he needs to do. But if he runs up against a brick wall in the shape of the Lowndes County authorities, and they simply do nothing, which appears to be this case, then what are you supposed to do?
Your Honor, respectfully,
What you're saying is, well, you hike it up to the IG. The Lowndes County authorities don't know the IG from Adam, and they don't care.
Right, Your Honor, if the GCMCA or another commander found, based on the Article 138 complaint, that there was a problem in the facility, and those claims are substantiated, then they can pull that member out of that establishment and place them in another confinement facility.
Ta-da. Or they can cease contracting with Lowndes County.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which, you know, the one thing that might move them is the fact that they've lost the money.
Absolutely.
But, if you're this accused, and you drop your coin into the well and it goes plunk down there at the bottom, and then the icky matter continues to run through your light bulb, what are you supposed to do?
Well, if you're asking about what this appellant specifically is supposed to do.
Well, by extension, his counsel.
Right, yes, Your Honor. Well, he's supposed to use the prisoner grievance system,
and
which this appellant did, and he did receive
and
relief.
And he did do, it appears, exactly what he was supposed to do, and got zero response. So my real question is not if the accused blows it off, or the GCMCA blows it off, but if the people running the jail blow it off, when everybody on the Air Force side is doing his job, then what do you do?
Well, you're, just 2 points that respectfully, I don't believe that he didn't receive any relief for the complaints that he filed. I believe that he did receive some relief for the complaints that he filed.
Well, yeah, eventually the icky stuff stopped running through the light bulb.
Yes, Your Honor, it did stop running through.
Well, I mean, that's something.
It is something, and the relief that's provided is doesn't always have to be necessarily perfect, especially when we're looking at Eighth Amendment.
We all agree on that.
But if there's nothing else that an individual can do if they've utilized all of the remedies that
That's the rub, isn't it?
It is.
There's nothing he can do. He's stuck there unless, A, the Air Force moves him, or B, the Air Force terminates the contract for non-performance.
Right. Yes, Your Honor, that's true, as long as they're using all the remedies available. But it runs into the same situation of if an individual files before the court and nothing, if they're not substantiated, there's not substantiated. And the individual
we're assuming they're substantiated.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. If they are substantiated, then an individual can just file them for the remedies.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, in terms of the remedies, service members are not on the same footing as civilians in terms of what they could get, because monetary damages are off the table.
Yes, Your Honor.
And money makes people pay attention. So for service members, that's gone. It would seem as if the approach here that has been used in the last 20 years of giving confinement credit is also a way to get the attention of the command. Because presumably they feel as if this convicted service member deserves to get whatever punishment was imposed, and they would not be pleased by the fact that that sentence would be reduced, let's say 3-1 credit. So if monetary damages are off the table, why isn't this a good approach to try to get change? Isn't it a two-pronged interest here? One is for this particular person suffering from these conditions, but also, secondly, to change the conditions. What's noted in here from the briefs of Appellant's counsel is that there have been repeated complaints over an extended period of time about this confinement facility.
Yes, Your Honor, to answer your question, monetary damages are not a good remedy, taking time off of an individual sentence is not a good remedy. It's not in the public interest to take time off of a person's sentence who's been convicted of sexually assaulting a child on multiple occasions. So that's why having the time taken off isn't a good idea. I mean, ultimately, I'm sure what a service member is asking for when they're complaining about these complaints is the actual conditions. And so one would assume that they'd want the conditions to be fixed instead of time taken off their sentence, although that might not be true. But that's ultimately what they're asking for. And so to say that a command would not want time taken off of the sentence, I agree that that's true. However, they still have oversight from other individuals aside from the courts when they have to send up their responses under an Article 138 to the Secretary of the Air Force or the Secretary of the Armies. So there is still oversight on what they're doing.
But what about the situation where, for instance, Senior Judge Stuckey was noting that originally it appears as if this service member was supposed to be in that facility for just 2 weeks. So there's this constant churning of service members through these, shall I say, substandard facilities, where because there's no monetary damages on the table, where is the incentive for anybody to make this change as compared to service member one experiencing these atrocious conditions for 2 weeks? By the time they've gone to, let's say, Miramar or Leavenworth, declaratory relief, injunctive relief, doesn't mean anything. And then you have the next service member being subjected to this for a few weeks, and then the next one.
Right, yes, and that was the point I wanted to make. The people that have complained about the conditions at this specific confinement facility, not every single complaint, even though there have been complaints, not every single complaint is exactly the same or has been substantiated or found to violate the Eighth Amendment. So it's not that the changes aren't being made at the facility, it's just that they might be unique problems, like the leak in the ceiling, for instance, is a unique problem to this specific appellant. It doesn't mean that all people that go to that facility are dealing with the leaks in the ceiling and they're not fixing it. So there is still incentive to fix these things, and they are fixing these things because they're having the complaints. And as Judge Stuckey mentioned, at some point, if all these complaints are being substantiated and commanders are having to deal with these issues on a regular basis, if they find them that they're substantiated, then they'll stop using the prison. And that is sort of a monetary sort of damage to the prison if they're going to lose having individuals go there because of the conditions of the facility.
Counsel, can I ask just for a point of clarification about why monetary damages are off the table? Does the Ferris Doctrine protect state civilian prison officials who violate people's constitutional rights from liability?
Your Honor, I will be candid. I have researched this issue, and it seems like in some cases military members are ferries barred from seeking monetary damages against civilian facilities just by nature of the individual status as a military member when they go in.
Thank you.
So is that because they're federally contracted?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know.
Are they barred under ferries because those confinement facilities are used through a federal contract?
Your Honor, I'm not sure based on the research that I did if it's because they're federally contracted. What I found is that because of your status as a military member and going in, being related to your military service, that's why they were ferries barred, not necessarily because of the federal contract. But that could be the case.
Counsel, may I ask another question? The Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals found that there was no Article 55 or Eighth Amendment violation, and you argue in the third part of your brief that that decision is correct and we should affirm that. Doesn't this make it a poor vehicle for deciding to overrule Irby and the other cases? I mean, if we can decide the case without overruling our precedents in your favor, why would we adopt your decision to overrule those precedents?
Yes, Your Honor, it doesn't make it a poor case just because the Air Force found that there was no violations under the Eighth Amendment Article 55. It just demonstrates how often these claims are coming up and how often these claims are not actually successful. And so if we're looking at an exception that was carved out of prior case law and not necessarily based off of any statutory authority, this is the case where this court could look at its prior precedent, and the government proposes that it should to determine whether or not it's still workable or not.
On that specific point, one of the factors that we look at in deciding whether to overrule a precedent is whether the precedent established is unworkable. And counsel for appellant in the brief says this really isn't unworkable, that the courts on occasion received these Article 55 or Eighth Amendment challenges, and they address them, and they grant relief or don't grant relief, but it's not unworkable in the sense that it's not bogging up the system or creating an unmanageable problem.
Yes, sir. We would disagree with that proposition that it's not unworkable. Just because the courts are going through and working through these issues doesn't mean that they're not bogged down with the issues. As this court stated in United States versus Gwynn, CCAs are not supposed to be clearing houses, but the CCAs do feel like they're clearing houses. They're saying that they are. The Air Force Court has said it feels like a clearinghouse as it starts to wade through these Eighth Amendment and Article 55 claims. And it creates this situation where you can't always look at whether or not there's been an Eighth Amendment or Article 55 violation just based off of the declarations. Appellant in this case has asked for debate hearings on multiple occasions because he believes that there's a discrepancy between the declarations or not, but it creates these situations where you can't always decide something based on the declaration. You certainly can't just decide it based off of what's in the record. So if we're looking at what's unworkable, just because the courts are doing it doesn't mean that they're not being bogged down, and it's taking time away from individuals who have credible claims under Article 66 that is actually covered by the statute. So the government posits that it is unworkable.
May I ask another question? One of the appellant's major arguments for us not overturning our precedent is that after these precedents were all decided, Congress undertook to amend Article 66, but they didn't do anything about those precedents.
Yes, Your Honor. And so you only look at that canon of construction if the statutes are unambiguous, and we argue that they are unambiguous. But also the Supreme Court has said that you can't look at Congress's non-action as affirmative approval of a court's prior decision. And so their non-action in changing Article 66 doesn't mean that they approve of this court's review of these claims.
Chief, go ahead. Getting back to Judge Maggs's point, though, if the courts are overburdened, and you may not know the answer to this question, and the only reason why I ask it because you seem to have some knowledge of your own, albeit outside the record, that the courts, the military courts, are having problems with this, the workload with regard to this issue. Let's assume, without saying so necessarily, that that's the case. Shouldn't they make those concerns, shouldn't they send those concerns to Congress, to the committees, and then, you know, let Congress do what it needs to do? I mean, if it's such a burden, why just sit there and complain that it's a burden and allow Congress to think that things are going well and there's no need for us to change the system that the CAF has set up with regard to these kinds of issues?
Yes, Ron. It's not outside the record that the courts have stated that they feel like a clearinghouse for these CCAs. And I can do a supplemental cite with a case where the Air Force Court says it feels like a
clearinghouse. I'll take your word for it.
Yes, Your Honor. So they have telegraphed that they do feel like a clearinghouse, and I think that that's the best that they can do in their opinions is to say that we're trying to dispose of all of these claims.
Well, can't the Judge Advocate General walk up there down the street here and say, knock on the door of the committee staff and say, hey, I got a problem down here?
Yeah, and Your Honor, may I finish answering?
Please do.
He could, yes, Your Honor, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he should, especially when the statutes are as clear as they are. They shouldn't have to be taking on the burden of saying, you know, we need the judge advocate to go down the hall. And
right, but if Congress has decided not to change things, and they're, as you say, or at least someone has said, we assume that they know what our case law is. Our case law says this is the process, and it seems to be working. And if the service courts or the services have a problem, shouldn't they disabuse Congress of the notion that everything is fine?
Perhaps they should be more clear than just saying that we feel like a clearinghouse with these claims and actually say something more specific. But the government believes that by saying that they're a clearinghouse, they have communicated that to Congress, or they've at least communicated it in their opinion.
Hmm. More questions from the bench?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I have many things I'd like to reply to, so I try to do it in the most expeditious manner possible. First of all, I'm not aware of the lower court making it known on any occasion, especially not in this record, that it feels like it's being overly burdened. A case I can point to is United States versus Johnson, brought up in both in our main brief and in the reply. Specifically in the reply, how a sitting CCA judge stated he needed answers to these questions about Lowndes County Jail, about the deliberate indifference of military officials, about the deliberate indifference of the prison officials, and even by name said there's a prison official that I need answers to and would have ordered a Dubay hearing. So that is something this court can look to as a CCA that is invested in this process and one CCA who can do it appropriately if permitted to do so. I'd like to talk about the findings and sentences entered into the record. That is a content limitation, not a temporal limitation. That allows the CCA and this court to look at the findings and sentence that are entered in the record so as to exclude other collateral matters such as access to voting rights, firearm prohibition, sex offender registration, those types of matters. When the code or the RCMs want to put in a temporal limitation, it does so with explicit recognition. Pretrial confinement, 24 hours to do this, 48 hours to do this. Submit your matters to convening authority within 10 days. Speedy trial, 120 days. The Congress and the President made no mention of a temporal limitation, and if it had intended to circumscribe Article 55 based on time, it would have said cruel and unusual punishment up until a certain time, nothing after that. It did not.
I guess I still don't understand how that's consistent with the fact that our review of these issues ends on direct review.
Well, that would be Congress's recognition of when this court has the authority to end. It doesn't mean that a service member is permitted to have cruel and unusual punishment inflicted upon him or her after such time. However, Congress has allowed and invested the authority in the CCA and this court to vindicate those claims within the time of the direct appeal.
I mean, how is that argument consistent with the Supreme Court's admonition that CAF is not given authority to oversee all matters arguably related to military justice or to act as a plenary administrator, even if criminal judgments is affirmed? We're having these policy discussions, you know, up here. It sounds like that's exactly what we're engaging in, exactly what the Supreme Court told us not to engage in.
I agree with Your Honor partially. I think these policy arguments indicate why retreating to the text and retreating to the precedent is the preferred course of actions. Policy arguments about what's the best forum or the proper forum should not guide this court. The CCA must determine what's correct in law. Article 55 is a law. It must be honored at all times. If the sentence is being executed in a manner that is inconsistent with the law, military appellate courts are required to look at it. And I would like to culminate my time addressing what Senior Judge Stuckey spoke about with opposing counsel, which is, what do we do if the jail blows it off? What do we do if the military commanders don't do anything about it? That's exactly why we need this.
Counsel, was the convening authority guilty of dereliction of duty, or was he guilty of maltreatment of subordinates, or accused of that in this case, or could he be?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, I see my time.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Judge Maggs, the wing commander performed his duties under Article 138 and engaged in an investigation. He found there were violations. His grant of the Article 138 complaint, because of the contract, could only be seen as a charge to the jail to get it fixed. But nothing got fixed. So I point to the Article 138 complaint to having two distinct purposes for the Eighth Amendment inquiry. One is it's evidence of deliberate indifference.
But it doesn't, that just goes to my point, which is that if you've alleged that Air Force officials were deliberately indifferent to the suffering of Air Force members, how is that not something that could be addressed through our ordinary UCMJ process of accusing them of maltreatment of subordinates or deliberate or dereliction of duty or some other offense in which it could be properly adjudicated? I mean, it seems a little odd that we just say, well, since you blew it off, we're not going to do anything to you, but we're going to give a sentence relief to somebody else. I mean,
respectfully, Your Honor, the wing commander and having a discussion about potential criminal liability under maltreatment or something of the sort is a much higher order santer than what we're talking about here. Deliberate indifference has been described in the arena of recklessness. And when we have a facility where there is a contract and you repeatedly send your people there and, in fact, blindly throw credit at members because it's easier than fixing the problem, that's the exact type of mindset that the Supreme Court and this court has admonished, the type that is the culpable state of mind deserving of relief. Pending further questions from the court.
Can I ask one last question? Just the chief touched on this earlier, but I want to make sure we get it clear. What evidence was in the record of these allegations that would have triggered under Jesse and Willman a supplementation of the record with more evidence? Do you understand my question?
I do understand your question, and the record is absent of that. My client's submission of matters to convening authority that occurred days after he was thrown into confinement didn't mention Lowndes County Jail. So the evidence in the joint appendix in the record began with affidavits and declarations to the court below.
More questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:40.
Well, you'll let me know.